After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. I'm Teddy Cahill. Joining me, as always, is Joe Healy. We will be joined in a little bit here by Tulane coach Travis Jewett to talk all things Green Wave Baseball and New Orleans Eating. But before we get to all of that, we have to let you know that the Baseball America College Podcast is presented by Rapsodo. Rapsodo has become the industry standard in player performance data. Coaches use Rapsodo data as a measuring stick for player development and evaluation. The Rapsodo National Player Database is a free service that allows you to see how you stack up against your peers and provides a pathway to get discovered by scouts. You can check out the Rapsodo National Player Database at rapsodo.com/national database. All right, Joe, we're back here on the podcast post-Thanksgiving. We're into December now as people are listening to this. It's kind of crazy that that's where we are in the calendar, but hopefully everyone had a happy Thanksgiving. I know it was probably a little bit different for a lot of people this year, but hopefully everyone was able to get some turkey or lasagna or whatever your meal of choice is for the Thanksgiving holiday.
Yeah, quick, before we get into anything deeper, let's do a quick Thanksgiving download. What was on your menu, however you did Thanksgiving this year, Teddy? What was on your menu? What was your favorite part? What was a highlight? How was your Thanksgiving?
So it was a little different this year. Well, it was very different for me this year, just beyond the everything surrounding 2020. But I had Thanksgiving dinner at my girlfriend's parents for the first time. And so they are from Egypt. And so we had a turkey, which is traditional in Egypt for Egyptian holiday cooking as well, as I understand it. But it was definitely spiced differently than I had turkey before. And their stuffing is a rice stuffing that gets cooked inside the bird. And then the sides, we kind of took it easy on the sides, it being, you know, just a gathering of five people. So it was not an intense number of sides. There were Brussels sprouts and green beans. There were mashed potatoes. There was another traditional Egyptian salad. But in my understanding, in a more typical year where there would have been more people, there would have been other sides. And I might have, you know, made a cranberry sauce or something that they weren't going to have, but, you know, is part of a Thanksgiving tradition for me. But in this case, we kept it simple. And then I made an apple cake. Effectively, it's an Allison Roman recipe, which you can check out online. But it was her sticky apple cake, which is effectively just an apple upside down cake. And then there was also a pecan pie.
Sounds like a pretty good spread. Sounds like a solid holiday there. Ours was, similarly different, just in terms of, we're trying to be safe and do it smart and do it the right way and all that kind of stuff. And that meant Thanksgiving was a little bit different. However, we still were able to do it. So we had with my family. So we used to be really abstract about Thanksgiving with my dad and my stepmom and my siblings. They would often do Mexican food. They are Texans. as am I, of course. And so we would do Mexican food on Thanksgiving. That was a thing for a long, long time, just because they kind of preferred it, and they kind of liked the idea of being a little bit different. And it's a funny thing when your parents start to get a little bit older, they start to get a little bit more nostalgic. They start to, I think, kind of cling to some of those older traditions. So now, last, I don't know, 5 years now, with me and my siblings being all grown now, they've kind of gone back to the more traditional Thanksgiving, I think, because again, they are kind of clinging to those older traditions, and they want to have that more traditional Thanksgiving feel again, which is totally fine by me. I'm not a huge turkey guy. I'm a big turkey leftovers guy. I love a good carved turkey sandwich with barbecue sauce on it, just as a base. I'll play around with what else is on it, but as a base, that's just a great way to start. So I like that. So we just did all kind of the traditional stuff, up to and including a cranberry sauce. My stepmom, I feel for her a little bit. She has this great cranberry sauce recipe passed down from her mom and perhaps her grandmother originally. It's been in the family for a long, long time. And it's, as far as cranberry sauce goes, work intensive. Cranberry sauce is not the most work intensive typically of sides. However, this one is, relatively speaking. And she puts a lot of work into it. And she's really the only one who eats it. And she'll make this huge bowl of it. And then every year it's like the same thing where she like realizes all over again that like, oh yeah, no one else really eats this. But she makes it, and by all accounts, it's good. And it's just not my kind of thing. I'll usually try like a bite or two of it. It's just not my kind of deal. However, so this year we had, my siblings just came in for the day of the meal, basically. And then I stuck around with my parents. My fiance and I stuck around for a few extra days. And so on actual Thanksgiving, we did go back to the Mexican food feast on the actual holiday. So that was kind of nice. Got the best of both worlds. Went back to the traditional thing with the larger group, which was still a small group in the grand scheme. But, and then the Mexican food with the smaller group, which was great because then it lasted 2 or 3 days after that. So we had some enchiladas and rice and beans. My dad stopped short of the sopapillas, which he has done in the past, doing the sopapilla desserts, but he is trying to eat a little better these days, trying to stay healthier. So he's staying away from powdered sugar desserts right now. So he didn't go that far. So a good Thanksgiving, different, but good. I got the best of both worlds in terms of the traditional and the Mexican. So I was happy with that. And now I am looking forward to eating a little bit lighter for the rest of time, given the way that we went.
That is the key, you know, in the following week is like, what do you do? Food wise, and something we get into a little bit here with Travis Stewart, not so much in the you know, Thanksgiving sense, more in the you live in New Orleans sense, but there are similarities between these two situations, I feel like. So you know, hopefully all of our listeners had a happy Thanksgiving. And you know, as we move into December now, where everyone is able to enjoy whatever year-end traditions, holidays, and everything, there's a lot that goes on in this time of year. So hopefully everyone is able to enjoy those as best we are able here in this strange, unprecedented year. I guess this has been the time of the show where we've kind of talk news the last few weeks. We have some news, but I think let's save that until after our interview with Travis Stewart. Let's just get right to that here, Joe. It's Tulane was an interesting team in 2020, a very interesting team, off to a 15-2 start. I know I was still trying to, you know, get a good feel for what Tulane was. They started the season very impressively. Swept Florida Gulf Coast on opening weekend, had a series win, maybe a series sweep against Fullerton, and they were about to host Long Beach State in what was shaping up to be like this very fascinating non-conference series the weekend that the season was canceled. So unfortunately, we weren't able to see that play out, but I you know, seeing the way that they had, you know, started the year and the progression of the program over the last couple, it's hard not to be excited. And then they come through the draft and they do lose, you know, Hudson Haskin, the big slugger in the middle of the order, but you know, they're able to return their ace. They return a lot of really good pitching, as we talk about. And, you know, as you look at the American going into next season, I don't see anyone running away with it. We haven't really, you know, hammered it all out yet, but, you know, UCF is going to be good again. East Carolina is going to be good again. Houston retooled a lot. So, you know, we'll see what that looks like. And then, you know, Wichita State, we had Eric Wedge on this podcast a couple months ago, a lot of excitement there. And, you know, Tulane, there's no reason not to be excited about them moving forward. And so I don't think any one of those teams is head and shoulders above the rest. I don't even know, you know, that there's, you know, I think UCF is probably our clear favorite right now, but I don't know how clear that is. So it'll be interesting to see the Green Wave, interesting to see how the American as a whole plays out. And so I'm excited to be able to talk with Travis Jewett here about his view on the team as he looks to the 2021 season.
Yeah, I'm with you in terms of excitement about this Tulane team and just being fascinated by the American Conference as a whole. I think, sure, there were SEC series that got canceled that were coming up that weekend, right when things got canceled. Of course, you know, ACC was underway, but some good series coming there. But I might be more frustrated that we didn't get to see Tulane and Long Beach, because those were two teams that I think we would have had a really clear picture of who and what they were coming out of that weekend, just because I think as much as they had accomplished, and they both had impressive wins on their resume, as much as that is true, I think there was also still like a little bit of nagging, you know, is this just kind of a team coming out hot? How are they going to stand the test of time? And I would have loved to have seen how that played out. And oh, by the way, Tulane had Dallas Baptist the weekend after that, which also would have been a banger. So Tulane really had quite a schedule lined up where they were really going to, if they'd have kept winning at that clip, and this is really putting the cart in front of the horse, but you know, if they win those two series or maybe even split them, they're in a position where, hey, if you play really well, if you win the American, maybe this is a host team. And again, that's the cart way in front of the horse. But I think that was in play for this Tulane team. You know, when you start with Braden Althoff at the front of the rotation, just off to an incredible start. And I think that was real in terms of it wasn't any sort of mirage where he was just pitching above his head, and then a really old offense. And now the flip side of that is they had a really old offense last year. And a lot of those guys have moved on either, you know, just matriculating through the program. You mentioned Haskin being drafted. So there is some turnover on offense, but last year it was a really old group and it seems like they've kind of got the pitching figured out a little bit. And so they kind of got robbed of being able to show what was what in 2020, but still there is a lot of lingering excitement about this group going into 21.
Absolutely. So with that, let's get to our interview with Tulane coach Travis Jewett. Today on the Baseball America College podcast, we're excited to be joined by Tulane coach Travis Jewett. Tulane was off to a 15-2 start this spring when the season was canceled. A really impressive start to the season there. For the Green Wave, coach, what clicked for this team, or for that team, I guess I should say, so early in the season that you guys were able to come out and have that kind of start to the 2020 season?
Well, I think first off, I want to say thank you for having me. I appreciate that. Anytime I can talk about this great university and our players, it's a welcome thing. So thank you very much. You know, I think really, Teddy, what happened was, you know, our guys loved playing baseball. I think they loved each other. You know, I think it was a very spirited, connected group. We talk about that a lot in terms of, you know, that those are things that kind of help the scoreboard kind of tip into our favor. So that continued to get better. They just enjoyed being around each other and played the game at a very passionate level. So that was kind of fun to watch. And then I think, you know, and you and I have known each other for a while, you know, I think what we're able to do in the years leading up is just trying to kind of get the pitching going a little bit. And through recruitment, you know, we were able to get some quality arms and some junior college help that was immediate impact. And so I really think that the ability to get the game established on the mound and kind of keep us into it, because we've swung the bat pretty okay in most seasons that we've been here. but this was a little bit different in the fact that we were just kind of always in range, you know, and we're able to do some different things. But I would say that the pitching, all in all, kind of set the year off to a good start. And so, you know, if you don't have that guy that can stand on that little brown circle in the middle of the field that's slightly elevated above everybody else and kind of get after the opposing offense, you know how tough it can be. So we're able to kind of establish ourselves there a little bit. And I think it just proved to us that, you know, that's what we got to continue to do to we can be in ball games.
Braden Althoff had probably the best numbers of any starting pitcher in the country over four starts in 2020, just incredible numbers across the board. At what point did you realize what you had in him? How impressed were you with what he did, and what was the key to his success?
Well, yeah, I mean, that was, you know, that was kind of without saying his name, you know, obviously that's the guy kind of that I was talking about that kind of got the weekend started for us. But, you know, he's just a complete pitcher, Joe. He's got three pitches that he can throw for strike blindfolded. You know, it's just like you hang your glove somewhere and he can hit the middle of your target. So for a guy to get up there and be able to throw his fastball to both sides of the plate, dump a curveball, and then it's just it's a swing and miss slider, you know? So he was just a huge addition. And again, one of those junior college kids I talked to you about earlier that we quote unquote hit on. And, you know, he gets everything he deserves, you know. I would say that his routine, you know, his desire to be great, his craft, it's evident every single day, even when he's not pitching. So very directed on what he wants to do, how he wants to do it, you know, and he's got a plan of attack, and he just goes out and was able to execute for us. So pretty excited about his return to this team for sure. I would tell you guys this, you know, he got even better this fall. And I know we're talking about those good numbers that he had last year, but the ability to stay humble, stay present, keep moving forward, you know, learning from past successes and failures and taking it forward. He had a great fall this year. So crystal ball says, you know, we're expecting great things for him again this spring.
You guys are in a little bit of an enviable position where you also bring back Aldrich and Benoit, the guys who had some starts for you in 2020. So you can kind of run it back if that's what you end up wanting to do. So how are you and Coach Latham kind of thinking about and working through competition on the mound, knowing that you have these incumbents, but you feel like you probably know what you're going to get, and then working from there?
Yeah, you know, we think we've actually even – last year I made mention that, you know, I think the big difference was the pitching strength. And I think we've even strengthened that more through recruitment and the return of those three guys for sure that you made mention. You know, Benoit has been had an incredible fall too. His velocity is way up. You know, he's perfecting his craft too. So we do have that with us going forward. You know, Jack is also a capable left-handed pitcher, another junior college transfer. So we do have that, but, you know, we've got some additions as well with some high school and some junior college arms. So just kind of playing it out, you know, right now. Had a kind of a interrupted fall, so to speak, but we are able to compete at the end. And, you know, I would say that those three guys are going to be right back in the mix to continue to do what they've done. And the competition that we've, you know, increased on, I think that's helped everybody get better. So that's what we're looking at going forward.
On the hitting side, there's maybe a little bit less consistency, maybe a little bit more turnover going into this year. What have you seen this fall from the hitters?
Well, not as much as I'd like, but I'm also, you know, when you're competing against yourself, it's a 50-50 thing all the time, right? So it's like, why aren't we hitting as good? Well, I would say because our pitching is a lot better. So it's kind of a win-win. But, you know, anytime you lose a Hudson Haskin, who was, you know, I think the 39th player chosen overall last year, you know, and then the experience with Ty Johnson and Artigues and Grant Matthews, you know, you do have some holes, but the recruitment, you know, we think we have some pieces. And again, the ability just to stay in range, we keep talking about. I always say, you know, we're like next door. We can always knock on Frank's door. That's my neighbor. We're not two blocks down or anything like that. So the ability just to stay in the game on the mound will allow us to, you know, kind of learn our offense and see what our strengths are going to be. But, you know, with the return of Avilas and Minder and, you know, Frankie Niemann and Colin Burns and some of these other guys, you know, I think we certainly have some pieces. And I like our left, right. I think we're going to be able to run a little bit more. I think we're going to be able to execute our offense a little bit more. You know, I think first few years we've kind of found ourselves standing around and kind of playing a little bit more station to station and trying to swing our way into games. Now I think we can actually try to ignite our legs a little bit and take the bat. And we talk about it being a wand and, you know, have the ability to create some off that way and do some things like that because of the strength of our pitching. And again, being in close games, be able to take a few more risks. So I like our pieces, you know, we just kind of got to get it all tied together. But again, the strength of our pitching, I think, will allow us to try to manipulate our offense a little bit.
Trevor Minder was a guy I was actually going to ask you about, you know, outstanding season last year after coming in from junior college, off to a really hot start. What can we expect from him in 2021? What allowed him to excel at that level in 2020?
Well, he's just a really good baseball player, period. You know, I mean, so the thing that I've always said about him is that he's got an internal clock that's meant to play this game. You know, he's never too high, never too low. He plays really good defense. He's a good base runner. And he's just gotten better too, you know, just like Olthoff and those guys. And I think that's what's most important. You know, those guys that have that success and things like that, it's just to stay centered, stay humbled, and keep moving forward. So I think, you know, we're looking at a guy that can man third base for sure and play it well. He can handle the hot smash. The ball always finds his glove. He can play on the run, throw from a bunch of different arm angles and stuff like that. And then offensively, you know, I think we've got a middle of the order type hitter that can hit for a high average. And I think you'll see his power develop too as he gets older.
You've had a little bit of a nice run of hitters here with Cody Hosey and Hudson Haskin. Is he the next guy up? Is there someone else that could be the next guy up as in terms of, you know, that big time middle of the order threat for the Green Wave?
Well, I appreciate you saying that. I do think he's kind of, you know, next in line. You know, I mean, you're talking about a guy that I think has a chance to play in the big leagues. And, you know, so we're going to be counting on him for sure. You know, we've got some other ones. We got a few sophomores that, you know, have kind of grown up in front of our eyes and haven't had a chance to play a lot, but they're, you know, doing good things. Colin Burns, the shortstop, and Ethan Groff playing kind of second base in the outfield. And then we also have Frankie Niemann, that's always been a good hitter. His power is developing. And then Luis Avilas behind the plate, you know, brings a pretty good power threat too. So, yeah, but I would say Minder, you know, looking at it on paper, he's kind of the, you know, the next guy, so to speak.
Not to take us back to the pitching necessarily, but I think one guy there's a little bit of interest in is a grad transfer you have in Jake McDonald, who some people might be familiar with his story just because he's had a really winding path and he's had some bad luck. And it just seems like things have never fully aligned for him at the Division I level. What can you tell us about him and what are expectations about him and what he can bring to the table?
Well, thank you for bringing him up. First and foremost, he is one beautiful human being. We are a better organization for having his feet inside of it, that's for sure. You know, I like the fact that he's been punched a few times, you know, but like anything, he gets off the ground, he dusts himself off, he's present. He's very aggressive kid. He's got a great arm, Joe. You know, and Coach Latham's done a really good job with him this fall. So we're expecting, you know, him to grab the ball in whatever role it might be and be a productive part of Latham's army.
This is going to be your fifth season at Tulane. The first two, you scuffled a bit under 500. And then you've made some pretty good progress over the last couple of years. Obviously, we didn't get to see where 20 was going, but you know, you had done a lot to build an NCAA tournament resume already, if you were able to, you know, keep that up in conference play. What's it been like to watch that kind of development and just a lot goes into program development and building a program. Just how do you look back on those first couple of years leading you to where you've been and where you're going now?
Well, thank you for the kind words there. Yeah, it's been a little bit of a haul that way. I tell the kids all the time, sometimes it doesn't happen on your watch, in the first couple of years. We had a lot of good players. I think we were just, short on the mound and in a lot of different ways. We had some capable people for sure, but just the length of it, the ability to do it consistently, was, not as present as it's been. So I think when you get somewhere, you got to look at it. You got to see where do you want to do? How do you want to get it there? And, I think we've just been able to, through the course of time, which it takes time, especially at a private school with high academic standards and cost, just to be patient and get your roster and the monies where you need it to be, And so we feel just through the course of time and every year we've tried to make some improvements and we just feel like we're getting the monies where they belong and starting to show up on the mound and go from there. So, we can't repeat last year, but what we can do is we can continue to, use the experiences and the positive experiences from the past and get that winning feeling, so that we can try to replicate it as best we can moving forward. So, I'm happy with the direction. I certainly would have liked to be faster, but I feel like we're doing it the right way. And, there's a humanistic thing with this thing too, in terms of roster changing and things like that. And so we feel like we've done a good job in handling that. And I think now, we talk about this around here a lot. It's just like deserving victory. And I think the way we go about it, the kids we have in here, the way they go about their business, train, all those types of things, I think we're starting to get some of that deserved victory.
I'm interested a little bit in your journey in your career. You had primarily your experiences out west until you get to Vanderbilt, and now obviously you've now you're at Tulane. And I think there's particularly in previous generations in college baseball coaching, it was very easy for coaches to get pigeonholed as being a West Coast guy or a Deep South guy or a Florida or a Texas guy. And you obviously have broken out of that. Other coaches have also broken out of that. We see a lot more of that these days. And I'm just curious from your perspective, if there's a key to being a coach who is able to have success in a lot of different geographic places and maybe what the commonalities are in the coaches who have been able to do that versus someone who's been in one region. And there's really nothing wrong with that. If you're comfortable, you're comfortable. But I'm curious about what it takes to be able to have success all around the country and what that entails.
Well, thanks again for saying that. I just really think it's all about personality and, trying to be diligent and share what's good about where your feet are, I just think whether you're born in Tacoma, Washington, like I was, doesn't mean that you can't develop relationships with people from Florida or New York or wherever. It's just about the willingness to do so. We have a great staff that will, go near and far, to share what's good about Tulane, and you're talking about one of the top universities in the United States and a destination city like New Orleans. We feel like our league is one of the top three or four rated RPI conferences in the country. So there's a lot to sell. And I think as long as we do a good job of just fostering relationships, making new ones and, providing an opportunity for, people's players, then I think that's how you become successful, even though you were born in a certain part or you coached in a certain part. It's just all about relationships. And we just think we got a hell of a thing to sell here, education and baseball, and we think we can do it both ends on a high level.
You coached at Vanderbilt during the 2014 national championship team. You were there from 13 to 16. What do you take from that time, and I guess specifically from that national championship season? What do you remember most about that group?
Well, what I take first and foremost is, when you're at a place like a Vandy, the components of the education and the baseball combination, and when I decided to leave there and come here. I saw so many mirroring qualities in the two institutions. You know, obviously they play in the SEC and we're the American, but you look at a lot of the similarities about world-class education and elite baseball opportunity. And I just think the older I get, you know, the more that education becomes important. And so it's fun to share with the kids that, you know, they can do both and we can still get to the big leagues from, you know, little old Tulane. So that's kind of what I took from there. And then obviously working with Coach Corbin, you find out, I made mention earlier about the scoreboard tipping in our direction. You know, I think there's a lot of things that come from, you know, just the team building, the relationships, the way you go about it, you know, that I think can help. And so we've mirrored a lot of that and tried to bring it forward, you know, because there's no reason not to imitate some of those things that obviously are successful. So that's kind of what I, when I left a place like that to come to a place like this, I just see a lot of mirroring qualities. So fortunate for my time there, you know, making mention of those quality teams that we're on and able to win national championship in 14 and play for one in 15. You know, certainly the quality of the character of the kids that we're recruiting, the investment, you know, just the, what they put into it every day to, you know, try to become the best versions of themselves. You know, I think that's where they separate themselves a lot. So, you know, that's what we're trying to mirror here. And I think been fortunate and lucky, whatever you want to call it, to have had my feet in those types of organizations with those types of successes so that we can hopefully share that with those that choose to come to a school like Tulane.
So we'll wrap up here with the most important question that Teddy and I ask to all of our guests. And I will filibuster here a little bit after I ask it to give you a chance to think on your feet here, because we're going to put you on the spot a little bit. But we ask all of our guests to describe their favorite sandwich. And so some coaches or players have just described how they make their favorite sandwich, and that's totally cool. You could tell us what kind of bread you want and the meat and the cheese, the sauces, what have you. Other times they tell us a sandwich they like from a particular local place. And so no pressure, but given that you're in New Orleans, I'm particularly interested in that part of it. But I don't want to leave the jury here. You can answer that question however you'd like. So please, Travis Jewett, explain to us your favorite sandwich.
Oh, here's a funny story for you real quick. I remember when I first got here, had some nice people want to take me out for a lunch. And, you know, when I think lunch, I think about a sandwich that I'll describe to you later. But we ended up going to a nice seafood restaurant and they ordered charbroiled oysters. And I was thinking, oh boy, you know, I thought going to lunch, I was going to get a sub sandwich, you know, but the ability to kind of open up and, you know, when in Rome, you know, type of thing. And now charbroiled oysters are some of my favorite things. But, you know, you made mention this is a destination city, man, with a lot of great food, no doubt about it. I will tell you guys on a podcast, I know you can't see me, but I gained some weight in those trying first couple of years. And I've actually lost like 45 pounds over the pandemic. So I bought a Peloton. And so sandwiches are few and far between these days. But if I had to have one, I go down the street to a place called Krabby Jack's and get a fried shrimp po' boy. And then they'd ask me, would you like that dress, sir? And then I'd look at them kind of funny. And then they'd explain to me what dress is. And that's mayonnaise, lettuce and tomatoes. And I'd say, go ahead and put it on there. And got a good, like French bread type roll and load it up with the shrimp and go for it. So I would say a shrimp po' boy, probably my favorite sandwich down here.
Well, I don't know about you, Teddy, but I was taking notes there. I have copious notes now, so I'll be prepared for my next trip down there.
Yeah, so when you guys come down, you got to just go down, take a left out of the parking lot and go down Claiborne Avenue. You'll find Krabby Jack's on your left. So
I mean, the beautiful thing about New Orleans is like right there, just all those places, like no matter where you are, you're like at most or two turns, like in a block from, you know, some great food that you can, whether it's a sandwich joint or like a big time restaurant.
Yeah, you just kind of got to be open to it. You know, there's just a lot of different ways to cut it up, but boy, they'll find a way to cook it up for you around here. That's for sure.
Well, that's awesome. That's great about the weight loss. That's you know, that's one way to burn time and calories, I guess, during during the quarantine.
Yeah, no doubt. I think I made mention I bought a Peloton bike, and that's just been awesome. So, but you know, I'm real proud of our guys. You know, I think everybody's starting to get that winning feeling. I think they understand how it is. I think culture, everybody uses the word culture, and I think a really good culture is just establishing kind of a way. And I think the older guys, because they're more knowing, they do more, right? And they replicate it more. And so I think we've got a nice group of old and new. And I think our older guys are doing a really good job of kind of carrying the torch. Excited about hopefully a full spring of baseball ahead. And, you know, the guys like you made mention, Olthoff and Benoit and Aldrich, and you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Keegan Gillis. You know, he'd been kind of a star for us for most of our time here, but we've moved him to the back of the games now. So it gives us a legit closer. He's been up to 97 this fall. So feel pretty good about not only the start of it, but the end of it, which is really important. And the guys like Jake McDonald and some of these other guys have given us some bullpen strength and some other midweek starter options. And so, feel good about it. And like my wife always said, she's like, well, hitting's never been a real problem, so you'll figure that out. So as long as you got the pitching to match it, then we can again, you know, try to become the best version of ourselves. We'll just figure it out, but feel good about some of the pieces that we have in play.
Absolutely. Hard not to be excited. And, you know, we're looking forward to seeing what it looks like out there on the field in 2021. And I know you are as well. And we really appreciate you taking the time to join us here on the podcast and break it all down for us.
Well, thank you guys. I appreciate your time. And I always enjoy following you and appreciate what you do for college baseball. And hopefully we'll see you at a ballpark in the near future.
Thank you again to Travis Jewett for joining us here on today's edition of the Baseball America College Podcast. Joe, we talked about this before the interview, just how interesting this Tulane team was in 20 and what they could have accomplished. And now, you know, we heard about what they have in 21. And, you know, there's a lot of reason for optimism on the pitching side. And Travis didn't really come out and say the hitting side. In fact, he actually sounded, you know, somewhat concerned about the hitting, but you know, he did mention that his wife said to him at one point, like, well, once you get the pitching figured out, you know, hitting's never been a problem for you. And that's true. You know, if you look at, you know, his tenure both at Tulane and then as a hitting coach and recruiting coordinator and as assistant coach, you know, that's what he does, and they've been very successful doing that. So you know, they might not be there right now, but if the pitching is legit and there's every reason to believe that, you know, I don't see any reason why the hitting won't come or at least be good enough for the Green Wave to be competitive at a high level in 21.
I tend to agree. I would like, obviously I would like the team a little bit more if they had some of those guys who are now gone. If they had some of those guys back, I certainly would like that a little bit more. But I tend to agree, and I think it just might be the kind of thing where maybe there are some growing pains early. You know, it's entirely possible. It's one of those deals where you look at the opening day lineup, and then 6 weeks later, you know, four of the nine are just completely different players in terms of, like, you know, run out the first nine, and maybe three or four of those guys just never get it going. So you sub in three or four other different guys, and those guys figure it out. And I think it could be a little bit of mixing and matching for Tulane, but I do have a level of confidence that at the very least, maybe it doesn't have the depth of last year's offense, at least what we saw early on in the season, because I think that was notable about that offense is they really ran, you know, five, six, maybe seven deep of guys that they appeared to really, really trust and were putting up numbers in one way or another. And maybe it's a little more like, you know, the offense, some of the offenses from a couple of years ago at Tulane where there were there was a little more inconsistency throughout the lineup, but you knew they had two or three real thumpers in the middle of the order that you always had to work around. And a lot of times that's enough if you get some contributions here and there from other guys in the lineup, as long as you have a handful of guys you know you can bank on. So maybe with a guy like Trevor Minder kind of being the Cody Hosey of this lineup, for example, that's putting a lot on him, although he also plays third base, so it's kind of an easy comparison to make. Maybe he's kind of the centerpiece, and that's where everything kind of revolves around him, and they can build an offense around a bunch of different guys who do a lot of different things. And maybe it doesn't quite look like the 2020 offense, but I'm confident it's going to get there. And to his point, they're not going to have to score as many runs as they've had to in the past, as long as the pitching continues to develop at the pace at which it appeared to be developing in 2020. And I think this is a Tulane team where I would really love, and we know there's just so much up in the air about scheduling, but this is a type of situation where I'd really love to know what their early schedule looks like, because I think depending on who they end up opening with, whether it's a conference foe and they're jumping right into conference play, or a non-conference foe, or whatever it is, I think depending on who it is will kind of give us a window into what we can expect, because you can see if they get drawn against somebody who knows their way around the mound a little bit, you can see a scenario where maybe they've some low scoring games, maybe they get beat up a little bit early on. On the flip side, if they've got some opponents they can handle early on and really give their hitters time to adjust, maybe they can get off to a hot start and weather that storm and then really take off from there. Of course, we're not going to get those scheduling answers in this year in particular, but this is the type of team where you'd love to know what they have in front of them, because you can kind of expect something out of that. But as it is, we're just going to have to kind of guess about that going into the season.
Well, you know, take it for what it's worth, but Tulane actually, there is some schedule publicly, and they're slated to start against Louisiana Lafayette. You know, obviously we'll see. But if that does happen, if they're able to play against Mississippi State and Troy like they want to, I know, you know, those are potential weekend series, then that would be pretty interesting as you try and evaluate them. Those would be good barometers. Now we'll see if any or all of those series are able to be played. You know, we've talked a lot about how open-ended scheduling is right now, and you know, the fact that you can say something is scheduled all you want in 2020, what's scheduled today very easily is undone tomorrow. So you know, we'll see. But to your point though, yes, right out of the gate, I'm interested to see what they've got, and whether that's playing ULL or playing say Houston, I don't really think it matters much. I think that we're going to learn something about them very quickly, and it will, you know, all the games in 21 are going to matter a lot, just because you never know. You know, we've seen football, we're seeing basketball right now, games get canceled, and right now there's no reason to think that won't happen to baseball on some level. So if that is the way it is, you know, every game becomes a little more important, because you don't know what might get canceled down the line. But you know, regardless, what Tulane looks like on opening weekend is, I agree, a prime storyline as you go into the 21 season.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about the idea of, we've talked around this a little bit, but I hadn't thought of scheduling in this way where, you know, thoughts and prayers to the teams that are really scuffling in these major conferences, because I'm not suggesting that teams consciously let off the gas if they win 2 out of 3 on that Sunday game, but I think that's kind of human nature sometimes, especially if you're on the road. But I think knowing that the games could be limited and knowing how important it could be to bank a sweep versus just taking 2 out of 3, if say your next weekend series gets canceled for COVID or what have you, that's going to make really not leaving any games on the table extremely important. And so if you're a team that's really struggling, I don't know that you're going to get a whole lot of those gentleman sweeps where maybe you take the Sunday game because the team has kind of accomplished their big picture goal and they're on the road and they're ready to get home and all that kind of stuff. Again, I'm not saying anybody purposely lets their foot off the gas, but you're certainly not going to see it in 2021 when everyone knows the importance of every single game on the schedule, especially if you're not going to be playing as many as you would otherwise.
Absolutely. I mean, it you know, we'll have plenty of time to break all of that down once we get a better idea of what's going on. But, you know, I do think that is, you know, going to be a reality as you look towards the spring. You know, the other thing I wanted to touch on here, you know, in relation to what he said about Tulane is just, you know, the way that the program has been built. You know, this is Tulane. This is a team that has College World Series in this century, College World Series appearances. You know, to his point, yeah, you can go to Tulane and you can play in the big leagues. You can go to Tulane and do a lot of things. So I mean, Sleeping Giant is not what they are, but I mean, Joe, I mean, when you got into college baseball, I mean, you've talked a lot about that on this podcast. Tulane was a big deal. And, you know, you grew up in Houston around Rice. I mean, I just see a lot of similarities between those programs, you being maybe a little bit closer to some of it. I mean, do you see that as well?
Similarity between Tulane and Rice, or the one he made between Tulane and Vanderbilt?
Well, Tulane and Rice. I mean, I know what he's talking about with Vanderbilt, partially because, you know, we've talked about that. We talked about that when he took the job, that, you know, he sees Tulane as private school, major city, elite education. All of these are things that he sold to recruits at Vanderbilt as the recruiting coordinator. It's very easy to sell similar things to them at Tulane. Obviously, you don't have it with the SEC. You aren't selling Tim Corbin. You're selling yourself. But I mean, there are similarities there. There are similarities between Vanderbilt, Tulane, TCU, USC, schools like that. And I get all of that. But when you like just looking at Rice and Tulane as like schools that are trying to get back to this, you know, big time history that they have, obviously for Rice, that means a national championship. For Tulane, that, you know, they didn't win a national title. They just went to the World Series a couple times. It's been a little while since they've been there, and now they're trying to do it in a new landscape. And it's just going to be interesting to see how that works.
Yeah. Well, I mean, my answer to both is yes, there are certainly similarities. One of the big ones at Tulane is that when Rick Jones really had Tulane cooking back at that time, they recruited Texas very, very well. And they've always recruited, of course, they recruit Louisiana well. But Texas was probably their second hottest hotbed at that time. And a number of their big recruits at that time were coming out of the state of Texas and in Houston in particular. And Tulane has it's obviously a smaller private school, so it doesn't have the influence in Houston that LSU does, for example. The LSU people will tell you that, you know, Houston is one of its biggest alumni bases. And I think I heard one time it's the biggest outside of the state of Louisiana. So there's that. But Tulane, there is some Tulane influence in Houston as well. I've known several people who, growing up in Houston, who went to Tulane. So there is that. So it is kind of a natural recruiting area. And Tulane did a really, really good job there. At the same time, Rice really had it cooking there. They're similar schools in terms of, you know, costly, high academics, private schools, things that really kind of made their hay on baseball, because Tulane famously, not typically very good. They've had their moments in football more so than Rice, but typically not very good historically in a lot of the other major sports, but really made a name for themselves nationally in baseball. So I think it was a great comparison back in 2005, 2006, 2007. The difference is Rice really kind of that had a little bit of a longer tail, whereas Tulane really kind of more precipitously dropped off before Rick Jones stepped aside and David Pierce took back over. What's a little bit interesting to me now with Tulane is that it was really interesting to hear Coach Jewett make the comparison to Vanderbilt, because I do think the way that team is built is kind of similar to what you see at Vanderbilt. And that feels like a conscious choice to me, where Tulane, because of its profile as an academic private school, has like I said, always kind of recruited nationally. However, I think it's more so now, whereas, you know, under Coach Jones, I think it was a lot of Louisiana, a lot of Texas, and then you'd sprinkle in, you know, some Florida, some other deep South, and then they'd pick and choose in other parts of the country. Whereas now I think you look at Tulane's roster and it is really, they've got a graphic in their media guide where it's, you know, they've got a decent, I think Florida is actually the state they pull from most. You've got Florida, you've got Louisiana, and then it's a lot of, you know, a couple kids from this state, a couple from that state, you know, one from, they've got one kid from 8 or 9 different states. So they are really are, and that kind of looks a lot like what Vanderbilt is doing now. And I think there was a impulse to look at Tulane's roster when Coach Jewett mentions those first couple of years and kind of struggling to get it going. I think there was an impulse for some to look at that roster and go, well, when Tulane was really cooking under Coach Jones, they were recruiting Louisiana, but they were really hitting it hard in Houston and, you know, Dallas a little bit. And those were their two big states. And it feels like they've gotten away from that. And maybe that's the answer to why they're struggling here. And now, though, I think it has kind of turned on its head where Tulane is clearly coming back in a positive direction. Maybe would have been back in the postseason in 2020. And now you start to look at their roster and you look at it the other way where you say, well, he's just building like Vanderbilt builds. And of course, there's a key difference here that Vanderbilt plays in the SEC, which is always going to be a little bit of a trump card recruiting wise. But now I think you can see it as a feature versus maybe as a bug. When they were struggling, it might have been a bug that, hey, they're recruiting. Why are they, you know, recruiting these kids from Illinois and other places in the Midwest and the Northeast? Why don't they stay with their bread and butter? But now I think you can look at it as like, hey, look, they know who they are as an institution, and they're going to go get these kids that fit that mold of the institution they're trying to be and the baseball program they're trying to be. And, you know, Travis Jewett's been doing this for a long time. He did it at Vanderbilt, and he knows what he's doing building these rosters. And now I think it's easier to see that as a feature of what's going on there, as opposed to a bug, which might've been the impulse when things weren't going so great.
Absolutely. I think there's a lot to that. And it's just interesting to watch them build. You know, obviously when you recruit at Vanderbilt, you have to recruit nationally. And then that, you know, changes, you know, maybe the way that you have been used to doing things and opens your relationships. Like he talked a lot about, you know, relationships, that's why you're able to have success in various geographic footprints. And well, as you go through your career, you build these relationships. And when you're at Vanderbilt, you have to build them in the Northeast. That's just a part of the Vanderbilt philosophy under Tim Corbin, is that you're going to have Northeast kids. So you build those relationships, you build them in Illinois, because, well, that's not that far of a drive to Nashville, pretty easy for a kid to go there. And then they continue to pay dividends no matter where you go. And, you know, he's far from the only coach that's happened for. I mean, if you look at South Carolina, Mark Kingston, you know, comes from Illinois State via South Florida. You know, South Carolina is now getting into Illinois pretty well because of the connections that staff made in that part of the country. And so, you know, I'm very interested to see where it goes from here. I think they're on a great track. You know, but we'll see what they have here on offer in 2021. Like we discussed, open American race, Tulane, definite contender, and probably fringe top 25 team as we start to build out a preseason top 25 in not too long.
Yeah, I think that's probably about right. We've said it 1,000 times. You know, if you're kind of a fan who might be looking to, you know, you've got maybe your program in a major conference and you're looking for somewhere else to put your focus in college baseball in the springtime, you really could do a lot worse than really kind of like locking in on the American, because I think there are a handful of teams there that are national level good this year. I think it could be a banner year for the American in terms of, you know, being able to have teams that can compete, not just to get maybe one team to host and then two others into regionals, but maybe this is the year they push to have a couple of hosts. Maybe one of those actually looks like an Omaha contender. It could be that kind of year in the American. So in addition to it just being a really talented year in a lot of places in the American. So I think if you're really looking for a place to throw some extra interest come college baseball season, the American's not a bad choice.
Absolutely. I would agree with that. All right, so before the interview, I mentioned we had some news to discuss here, and so like let's get to that here, Joe. I guess the news is maybe multi-part. For fans that have been following our at Baseball America's reporting of the reorganization of the minor leagues, you may remember a month, 6 weeks ago, J.J. Cooper reported that the New York Penn League would be going away and Major League Baseball was, you know, talking about turning it into a summer college league. Well, that has now
come to fruition with an announcement on Monday, November 30. Five teams, four coming from the New York Penn League, a fifth coming from AA, a sixth still to be announced, will come together to create the MLB Draft League, which is going to be open to every draft eligible player, but primarily expected to draw on rising seniors and graduated seniors to play a season, play leading up to the draft, which again has been moved to the middle of July, All-Star Weekend for MLB. So they'll get a chance to showcase themselves in a league, in a pretty condensed league. Easy to scout, easy to get seen, get your all your metrics on file for teams in one place leading up to the draft. And so they've created this league, and it is going to be run by Prep Baseball Report. And hired to run the league as its president is Kerrick Jackson, who has been the coach at Southern for the last 3 years. And I think that's probably the most like college baseball, NCAA baseball. Significant news is that Kerrick Jackson is leaving Southern after three seasons, did a very impressive job in turning Southern around. Southern has the richest baseball tradition of any HBCU. They've won 27 SWAC titles in the last 60 years. They have an NAIA national title. Roger Cador, had the program really humming 15 to 20 years ago. In the last years of his tenure, however, things slowed down. They struggled a lot off the field, which led to some APR problems, which led them to being banned from the postseason. And so Kerrick arrives three seasons ago. They're not good. They win 9 games. And then they have the biggest turnaround in the country, 2019, win the SWAC, go to regionals, and we're off to a fine start in 2020. It's hard to judge a team like Southern until they really get into conference play, just because of the schedules they're playing. But they were off to a pretty good start. Every reason to believe that they were still one of the best teams in the SWAC. It certainly looked like that early on. And now, they, as you look to 21, should be one of the favorites in the SWAC again. So now some turnover happening at Southern. Chris Crenshaw is going to take over the program on an interim basis. I expect him to coach this spring. He played at Southern, coached at Southern for the last 2 years, previously was the recruiting coordinator at Jackson State for 5 seasons. One of the best recruiters in the SWAC, would be very capable if they hire him. Definitely deserves a very, very long look by the administration. That is, that's the one end of this. The other end is this new league, which again is going to mostly be for rising seniors and graduated seniors to get another look. That there's been a lot of chatter, maybe some confusion. The way that this has been framed in the release from MLB has kind of been that this is for top prospects, in air quotes, their top prospects. It's not. Like, that's not who's going to play in this league, at least not in its infancy. It's going to be more for when I talked to Kerrick, he talked about the players that like he thinks would be great for this league are low to mid-major players who didn't get seen as much, be that because of their location or just they overshadowed. Scouts can only do so much. So this would present them an opportunity to go out and get seen. Maybe a player from a major program who didn't get a chance to do what he show his ceiling in the spring. You're a pitcher at an SEC school and you have the ability to start, but like your team has 3 top 5 round
pitchers as starters already. So you're off as a setup man. Well, maybe this league gives you the opportunity to go out and show that you can pitch for 5, 6 innings, 7 innings, whatever, and you can start. So something like that. Or, of course, if a player is hurt in the spring but can get healthy and get back on the field in time to play in this league, it would be a great league for them as well. So that's the kind of players I expect to make it up for the first few years, at least. Maybe as things become more established, some of the top-end players are more willing to put themselves out there and play in this league. But to think that they're going to do that right away as everyone tries to feel out this new draft system, I don't think it's going to happen if you put enough track record together in your junior season. You're probably going to shut it down after the draft if you feel like you're a top 100 pick. I'm not anticipating those kinds of players going to the Cape, although some of them might. I'm not anticipating those kinds of players going to this MLB draft league, though again, some of them might. But maybe down the line you'll see that. But at least for right now, I think what you're looking at is kind of a showcase league for players that still have something to prove for one reason or another.
I think that's right. And I think what, I think what the kind of the caveat you have there of like, we'll see what it becomes down the line. I think the gap there that could be made up is if it becomes the type of thing where players go there and because the coaching is either so good, you know, they get the right guys in there that really are focused on player development, or the tools they're being given are so good that these players really see fast, you know, huge improvements just in that, in the time span that this league takes place. And of course, if that type of thing starts happening, then that's all it really takes for a different class of players to suddenly be interested in the league. And of course, it'll just take time for that reputation, if that takes hold, to take hold. So we'll just have to see a little bit further down the line on that, because you could see the scenario where MLB really, it's clear that MLB really wants to, you know, it makes it sound menacing when I put this, but it really wants to control kind of this whole process of the player from beginning to end. And you could see a scenario where, you know, MLB really puts some resources behind this and is really serious about this. And suddenly it kind of opens up some doors for some players, for some opportunities they may not have. And oh, by the way, chief among them are the types of players that you're describing, you know, low mid-major division ones, D2 players, you know, junior college players who maybe, or I suppose, would junior college players even be a part of this, I guess, is my question to you.
They will. Any draft eligible player. That includes high schoolers. You know, maybe you're a high schooler in Canada, and, you know, if you're not playing with the Canadian junior national team, hard to be seen. It's just kind of the reality of the situation up there. Or, you know, some cold weather state or some under-scouted state, maybe. But I would not expect high school players, junior college players for sure. I do think there will be them in the league, but a high school player would probably end up pretty overmatched there. So I think it would have to be the right kind of player trying to do a specific thing in the league.
Yeah. So, you know, the junior college player, we know that profile well, a guy who maybe he's not super keen on school, is worried about qualifying, it's late in the process, he's got some raw tools, he's not a finished product, you know, that type of guy maybe thrives in that situation. So yeah, those are the types of players that I anticipate being interested there. Happy for Kerrick Jackson, you know, a guy that I enjoy talking to. I know you enjoy talking to him. I always appreciate coaches who are interested in things beyond just their program and the wins and losses. And even interested in things beyond, because I think on some level, all coaches are interested in developing players and developing people and what have you. But I think his interest even kind of goes beyond that. He's really interested in a lot of big picture things in the sport. And I don't just mean diversity. That's the thing I think we'll most associate with him, that the work that he's done in terms of trying to bring more diversity to college baseball. And that's really admirable work. But he's even beyond that, he's just really thinking a lot about the sport and how to make the sport better. And he cares about HBCU baseball. He cares about low major baseball and trying to make the sport more equitable for those programs. So I'm sad to be losing a guy, a big picture thinker like Kerrick Jackson at the college level. Although who knows, you know, maybe we'll see him down the road. Certainly this type of job is not going to disqualify him you know, getting back into it at some point. So sad to see him go from the ranks, sad for Southern. Obviously they're losing a guy who's really transformed that program quickly, as you mentioned, and hopefully whether it's, you know, Coach Crenshaw or someone else down the road, they can kind of keep what he's built on and keep that momentum going forward into the future.
I should mention that part of the reason why Carrick felt like this was the right move for him is that PBR is going to kind of endow a foundation that he'll also be in charge of, that will be about promoting diversity within amateur baseball, kind of taking what he has done with the ABCA Diversity Committee and just giving him the time and the resources to really dedicate to it. Because while he and Spencer Allen and all of the coaches on that committee, Mark Martinez, they're really dedicated and they want to, you know, do the work to make the changes that they feel like they need to promote, you know, getting more minorities into the amateur ranks, coaching and playing. They also have their own teams that they have to be coaching, and that's a full-time job. And as much as they want to be doing this, like, that is A, the job they're being paid for, and B, if they aren't successful on the field, it's going to be much harder for them to, you know, get their messages across to achieve the change that they want to achieve. They need that platform. So, you know, it's just hard for them to do both at a really high level. And so to now have the opportunity to focus a little more time and just be a little more directed about it, I think that was a big part of the reason why Carrick felt comfortable leaving Southern, is because he still has this other, you know, he still has this outlet to do that part of it. As he described it, he didn't want to just take a job just to have a better title. He wants a job with a purpose. He had a purpose at Southern, and now he still feels like he can have a very high end purpose. Not that he couldn't have had the purpose as the president of the MLB Draft League, but he felt like, I guess, his purpose was greater at Southern than just being the president of the league. But now with the foundation aspect added in, he's able to, you know, continue, you know, striving towards that greater goal that, you know, like you said, these big picture items, he still has that outlet for those.
I guess my final word on this will be, I think there'll be a lot of time to dissect the what does it all mean in all capitals type of thing, and to kind of sort out, because I think there is a little bit of confusion as to where this fits in the summer ball. Like, it is a summer league in a sense, but it's kind of not in another sense. And so I think there is just some time. I know there might be some confusion about where it fits and what it means. We'll obviously have time to sort that. But what I will say is I'm always going to be in support of anything that you know, gives an opportunity for players to get scouted, be seen, give them an opportunity to figure out what's next in their careers. I'm always going to root for players having that opportunity and having more information and being a little bit more in control of their next step in their careers. And I think this does that. We can argue about the logistics and if it's going to accomplish some of the things they wanted to accomplish, but I think just more opportunities is better.
Absolutely. I think everyone can get behind that ideal. So that was the big news. You know, obviously a slower time coming out of the holidays, a little less newsy. It's your big news for the week around college baseball. Joe and I did another top 25. We ranked the top 25 additions in college baseball this year. We tried to do it as all-encompassingly as possible. So we got freshmen on there, we got junior college transfers, four-year transfers, we got coaching hires. It's all kind of mashed together. Honestly, when I proposed it, I don't know that I realized quite how difficult this was going to be. You know, trying to, you know, you've got a grad transfer who might be great, but he's only there for 1 year. So, like, how do you judge that versus a freshman versus, you know, who could be there for 3 or 4 years versus a junior college player who could be there for a couple of years versus, of course, like a coaching hire who's there for an indeterminate number of years. And, you know, if you just focus it on the 2021 season, then, you know, all of a sudden, well, freshmen become much less valuable then because, you know, how many of them are going to play prominent roles? And, well, how much change can a coach really have in 1 year? So I don't know. I don't know how good of a job we did organizing it, but it was interesting to think about and to put together.
Yeah, and even within those individual groups, there's just a lot of different reasons why someone would be included on the list. I mean, I think with coaches, for example, I don't think anybody would be surprised if Edwin Thompson has Georgetown, certainly in a more competitive place, pretty much right off the bat, but then maybe challenging to get to the first regional in program history in short order. And then you go a little bit further down the list, and I don't really know that anyone has that kind of expectation for Kyle Hallock at Bowling Green. However, you know, he's an important piece because he's
Not after like a couple of those players transferred in between the time the program was cut and the program was reinstated.
Indeed. I mean, but he's a young, energetic coach whose primary job at this point is of course, winning games is part of that, developing players is part of that. But really his biggest job is just to give Bowling Green some stability here and kind of lead them out of this turbulent period in the program history. And so he's just going to be an important figure in terms of setting Bowling Green up to have success in the next 15 years, more so than maybe even the next five. So if they win some games along the way, that's great, but it's really about kind of almost just starting back from scratch with Bowling Green. So there's a little bit of a different approach and expectation there. And there were some, what I liked about doing this list is we've done some similar lists this off season, and it was kind of nice to re-examine some of the names on this list. You know, I thought about a guy like Lyle Lockhart, who ranked fairly highly on our list of top 25 transfers. But at the time I was kind of dubious on his stuff is just kind of okay. And he was good at Houston, but he wasn't dominant. Is he a guy that's really going to be able to succeed in the SEC? And after talking with Dave Van Horn, it sounds like he was really good this fall and they have a lot of confidence in him. And I feel the same way about Benjamin Sims, a nice shortstop at Kansas, but can he go to a team like Michigan that expects to, you know, now has an expectation of winning Big Ten titles and going back to Omaha and all that. And does he really fit in there? By all accounts, he sure does. Or Scott Dubrule at Mississippi State, where, you know, can he step in at second base? And it sounds like he's going to get every shot to do that. So it was kind of nice to be able to revisit what we know about some of these, especially these transfers now, and kind of take a fresh look at what we expect for them come next season.
Absolutely. And, you know, we did the freshman list and it was kind of just like, here are the 25 best. And like, this was maybe a little bit more trying to find impact, but also, I mean, we've just, it's been a couple months since we did these lists and, you know, things change. And that's the beauty of player development, especially with amateur players who are young and, you know, still growing. And, you know, previously it was more about what they did in high school, and now we're looking at what they're doing in college. So I check it out. Number one on the list, Carson Montgomery from Florida State. Number two, Kevin Parrotto, Georgia Tech. Feel good about those two. Feel good about what they can accomplish in the ACC both this year and beyond. So it'll be fun to look back on this list next year, a couple of years down the line, maybe, and see how things actually went. But for now, I found it to be an interesting exercise. All right, so that's going to do it for us here on the Baseball America College podcast. Remember, you can check out everything over at baseballamerica.com, and you can also place a pre-order for your Baseball America Prospect Handbook, where we rank the top 30 prospects in every big league organization. So if you're looking for that as you start to get ready for the 2021 professional season, you can place your pre-order for that. Now, you can follow Joe and me on Twitter. I am at Ted Cahill. Joe is at Joe Healy BA. And please, if you are not already, we would love it if you would subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcasting app, Apple Podcast, Stitcher, Spotify, anywhere where you get your podcast. We appreciate everyone who subscribes, rates, reviews. It is a big help to us and for others to find the podcast. We'll be back here next week with another edition of the Baseball America College podcast. I believe we will be joined by Mississippi State slugger Tanner Allen. So we're looking forward to that, and hopefully you will be as well. Thank you guys for listening. Thank you to Travis Jewett for joining us here today on the Baseball America College podcast presented by Rapsodo. For Joe, I'm Teddy. We'll talk to you next week.
After the end of a good fight, you deserve an ice-cold reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. You've earned this rich golden lager with a crisp, refreshing taste. Because you know, the bigger the fight, the better the reward. You put in the hours, the energy, the tough labor. You are a fighter, and Medela is your reward. Medela, the mark of a fighter. Drink responsibly. Beer imported by Crown Imports, Chicago, Illinois.